Going to shift our attention now to climate and weather with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, one of our guests. And he's with me in the studio right now. And Professor John Martin will soon be joining us. He is chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And like all of us here, he teaches too, and he has a class. He has a class that will be finishing in about 2 minutes, I think, and then he will be on his way over, and so probably be joining us at around noon. So, if you have a climate or weather question for us, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. And Steve Ackerman, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
It's great to be back in wintry type conditions.
Yeah, we got the snowshoes out this weekend.
Oh.
And did some snowshoeing and had a lot of fun. We bought a pair of snowshoes for our three-year-old daughter, Emily.
Oh.
And she did very well on
Wow.
those snowshoes. Although I brought along one of these little plastic sleds.
Just in case.
And I think about halfway through, Emily transferred from the snowshoes to the sled, but it was fun.
Yeah, I got some snowshoes a couple of years ago, and I haven't used them yet because whenever I go out there, I'm afraid of two things. One is getting tired and nobody pulling me on a sled. And the other is that, you know, I like the cross-country ski. It seems to be a little bit easier and you go a little faster. So
yeah,
this weekend I went cross-country skiing instead of snowshoeing.
It was a lot of fun being outside and having a chance to do that. Yeah. Well, what about this weather we're having? How much credit do we give El Nino for the weather that we're having?
Yeah, when we look for the past month or so, or even into December and January in particular, we've had well above average temperatures. I mean, most of Wisconsin is about 7 degrees above average. And precipitation has been below normal, about 50 to 75% across the state, depending on where you look. And we predicted that that would happen because we knew El Nino was developing in the Pacific. So this is very consistent with the picture we see with El Nino, where we generally have warmer winters in the upper Midwest and less precipitation.
Yeah. It's cold now.
It's cold now, and wait till this weekend. There's another cold blast of air sitting up in the Arctic that's heading our way. So if you're going to sit home and watch that famous football game, this would be a good time to do it. It's indoors because it's going to be cold.
It's going to be cold. Well, Charles at Ocana Falls has a question for you, so let's go to Charles. Charles, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good late morning.
Yeah, good morning.
My wife and I were discussing the stargazing and the clarity of the night sky, and she was suggesting that she felt that the stars were more visible in the winter than in the summer. And I thought, well, I think it's just that there's more twilight in the ends of the day. And she felt that, no, she was thinking about 10:30 at night. That's her common time to look at the stars. And so my question is there enough difference in the humidity in the air between, you know, winter versus summer to have any effect on the naked eye looking at the stars?
I would have agreed with your wife that, yeah, in the wintertime, the humidity is down. Or another way to maybe think of it is the higher humidities that we see in the summertime. As a result of getting those higher humidities, sometimes we get hazes developed. And those hazes, those small, tiny particles suspended in the lower atmosphere will scatter that skylight or starlight and not make them quite as visible.
Huh.
So I would go, too, that those drier wintertime conditions probably make for the viewing better.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's not as comfortable.
No, it sure isn't.
Well, excellent.
Thanks, Charles.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call. And Dennis in Duluth, it's your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is more of the current weather going on. It's as cold as it is right now today. I've been noticing that there's been this somewhat of a warm spot near the Black Hills of South Dakota. And I'm trying to figure out, is it an elevation thing that's causing that? They've had recent 45, 50 degree temperatures while it's been cold here, obviously. And
yeah.
You know, what's causing that? Is it compression winds, Chinook winds? I don't know. I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, do you know what the winds are? Or did you just see the temperature?
Just the temperatures.
Yeah,
you see the temperature gradient, and it was almost green. It's been so much warmer than what's going on here.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, we're in the mid-teens to 20s right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would bet that it's not the compression of winds like you get along the Front Range of the Rockies, and that it may be associated with the elevation in the sense that we have a cold pool, a pool of cold air right now, and there's another one up in the Arctic working its way down. And those cool air masses are sometimes very shallow. And I lived in Colorado, and a lot of times, you know, you could just go up a couple of hundred feet up the side of the foothills there, and then all of a sudden enter some pretty warm air masses, a lot warmer than what was down below.
Because basic temperature inversion, in other words.
Part of it would be a temperature inversion, but part of it would be that that cold air mass may only be 100 feet deep. Mm-hmm. And so if you got elevation that, you know, rises to 200, 300 feet, then you could be out of that really cold air.
And you get, in Duluth and Superior, don't you get some temperature changes even there with Duluth being higher up than Superior?
Superior, we do. Occasionally, anytime the wind is out of the west, we get compression heating as the wind comes off the higher elevation, and Superior will be 5-6 degrees warmer quite often during the right time of year.
Okay. Yeah. So you're not talking like the downslope winds in the Front Range of the Rockies where you can get 20, 30 degree differences.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's similar to that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, same air. Air as it sinks.
It's only a 600 foot elevation difference.
Yeah.
Oh, it's that big.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that tall.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. If you'd like to join in, we're talking climate and weather with our guest, Steve Ackerman. John Martin will be joining us soon. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. We always say climate and weather, and somebody wanted to ask, what is weather and how does it differ from climate?
Good question. I think they're easy to define. It's when you begin to get into some of the particulars. So like I think of weather as it's the condition of the atmosphere at a particular moment at a particular location. So, you know, we go outside, we measure the temperature. That is a weather feature for today. Whereas some people then say, well, climate is just the average of the weather. But I like to think it more precisely as the collective state of the atmosphere for a given place over a specified interval of time.
Yeah,
and the reason why I like to think of it in terms of the collective state is that, you know, on the evening news, they'll report what the weather maximum, what the temperature maximum for today was. And that's kind of like a weather feature. And then they'll also give the normal temperature, which is really just a climatological average of temperature. But it's only one part of our climate, because we're not just about temperature. We're about what is the humidity, what are the winds, what are the cloud covers. So I like to think of it as the collective state in terms of climate.
And what is the time period required for climate discussion?
It depends on what you're studying. So when you hear in the evening news when they talk about the normal temperature, which is just an average temperature, that time span is usually 30 years. So a lot of times you got to be thinking at least 30 years. Sometimes when you look at global warming trends, then we're looking, or on geological timescales, then oftentimes we're looking at timescales that are, you know, on the orders of centuries. So much bigger timescales.
Much bigger timescales, schedules. 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890. Let's go back to the phones, and Carlton in Sugar Camp, you're next. Carlton, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question. It's a global warming question and climate change related, sea level rise related. I just recently saw a summary of a UN study that was forecasting sea level change over the next 1,000 years, and I believe I may not have my numbers exactly right, but they had forecast a continued warming, global warming, and a sea level rise.
I think we may have lost our caller there. Well, there have been some pretty interesting predictions as to that amount, and maybe you know.
Yeah, there are three things that are going to contribute to sea level rise in the scenario of a continued global warming. One is that as ocean surfaces of the water bodies of the oceans get warmer, they're going to thermally expand. And so that's going to cause it to go up. The other is if warming continues to occur, the glaciers in the Greenland and Antarctica, if they melt, they're going to contribute a lot more water to the oceans, which will cause sea level rise to come up as well. And then plus, if those glaciers melt, then there's also a rebounding effect. So the land that they're on right now is depressed down because the ice is replacing them, so some of that land will come up.
But
the main thing is that if the glaciers melt, they're going to add a lot of extra water to the oceans.
On the order of feet.
Yes, yeah.
On the order of feet.
And we're not talking a couple of feet. We're talking like 20 feet. So a lot of coastal regions will be underwater, like New York City.
20 feet. New York City.
New York City will be underwater. We'll have to put dikes up if, you know, in this scenario, if we don't do anything and we just continue the warming trends that we've been seeing over the last century.
Thanks again, Carlton, for calling. Appreciate it very much. John Martin just joining us. Hi, John.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
Well, I'll turn your mic on, and then I'll be doing better.
How's that? Great.
Good to have you here. And he's primed and ready to answer your questions.
All the tough ones. Go to John.
Yeah. We'll give John all the tough ones because he was late today. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our guests, our weather guys, talking climate and weather, and they'll be with us till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be right back with our guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Talking climate and weather now with our two weather guys, Steve Ackerman of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Pleased to have them both with us, and certainly you can join in with your questions as well. We have an open line or two, and you'll be able to get on and talk with them. And there are some questions. Somebody wondered about anti-cyclones, not anti as your aunt, anti-cyclones. And we'll talk about those. What causes westerlies and what is their function? We've talked a little bit about climate and what is climate compared to weather. We'll talk about what are fixed influences on climate. That's a question that I'd like to ask. And have these fixed influences changed over the course of time? We'll deal with that and a whole lot more and take your questions. Stay with us. News is next. Talking climate and weather now with our two weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the University of Wisconsin. Glad to have you join us. And if you have a question, we have some open lines, so we'll get you on fast here. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give a call. We'll be glad to get you on. And we got an email from someone who wondered about a guest that Joy Cardine had on her program who talked about Al Gore's documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. I guess the guy was questioning something relating to what comes first, CO2 or the warm weather. And he says rather than atmospheric CO2 content causing warming, the person who was Avery suggests that the data should go the other way around.
Yeah. I didn't hear. I didn't see the show, but I've heard this argument before, and it's a confusion between causation and correlation again. Mm. So you observe something. Like if you come into my kitchen, and you say, "Oh, I see you don't drink wine," and I ask, "Why do you say that?" And they say, "Well, because I see you have clean wine glasses."
Yeah.
It's just like, well, good observations, yeah, but wrong conclusion.
Yeah, right.
And so the issue here, as I understand it, is that you know, if you look at the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, there is a seasonal cycle. And so we have more carbon dioxide in our winter months when it's colder. Therefore, Gore is wrong. You know, how could they be correlated? How could global warming and carbon dioxide amount be related? And the problem is that, again, that's a good observation, but they're not understanding the causes of what's going on in this seasonal cycle. It's driven by plants. And in the wintertime, plants are dead. And when they die, they decay. And when they decay, they add carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So that's why the carbon dioxide amounts are increasing in the wintertime. It's not because the temperature is colder, and therefore that, you know, more carbon dioxide means colder temperatures. No.
And the other comment was that a good deal of the recent warming is due to a 1,500-year cycle of warming and cooling, and that we are sort of at the, if you looked at the data over time, and that we're now at sort of the almost to the peak of that cycle where it's at its warmest.
Yeah.
Except that this rate of increase far exceeds anything in a 1,500-year cycle that's detectable in any of that data. So this one, even if it were spurred, perhaps, or encouraged to exist at some because of some 1,500-year cycle, it far exceeds any of the magnitudes we've seen before. So it's not just coincidence.
Yeah.
It can't be. It's like a conspiracy theory. And that's why as years go by and more evidence, some seemingly small pieces accumulate, you just end up not being able to make a coherent, comprehensive explanation except to conclude that something is up here and it's not a natural variation entirely.
Yeah.
Let's go to Bonnie in Sirona now. Bonnie, hi to you.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a question about the jet stream. Well, I used to hear about the jet stream all the time when I was a young girl, mm-hmm. but now I very seldom ever hear about it on the weather reports, and I was wondering why.
So you're talking about like 10 years ago you heard it a lot?
Oh, no. Don't I wish. Thank you. Maybe 30 years ago.
Okay.
I got a feeling that's because a lot of the TV weather stuff is now hiding behind a lot of glitzy presentation graphics, and it strays a little bit from actually trying to educate people or tell them what might underlie the forecast a little more than they used to do in the past. Tom Skilling is an exception. He's got the jet stream out there. I think the Weather Channel used to make a bigger use of such graphics. I agree with you, and that was within the 10-year-ago time frame. I don't think they do it so much anymore, though I'm not a constant watcher. But it hasn't lost any of its importance. It's one of the central organizing factors for our weather in the middle latitudes, particularly in the fall, the winter, and the spring. And so it's right up there as one of the primary things that a person like myself or my students, when we go to make a forecast, that's the first thing we're going to look at is what's the jet, how strong is it, where is it located, what curvature is there in it, things like that.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad to hear it's still there. But
oh, yeah. It's still there. It's still there. That's why it takes so long to go from San Francisco back to Madison.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Other way around.
You mentioned Tom Skilling, and he was some Wisconsin roots, a guy who was in Madison, weather.
Yeah.
I think he graduated from here, too.
That's correct, yes.
And then was in Milwaukee at, mm-hmm. believe, WTMJ, and now in Chicago at WGN in Chicago.
Yeah.
So
great forecast. I love listening to that guy.
Oh, me
he
too.
Explains everything clearly and quickly.
Yeah, it's a mini lecture. It's just an absolute model in concision and precision. He's outstanding. I've written him and told him that, too.
Brian in Madison, hi to you.
Hi. I always hear about people seeing interesting atmospheric phenomenon and then calling in, and I finally got my chance.
Good.
About a month ago. I work nights, and I leave work around dawn, and I came out, and I thought I saw the sun rising in the west, and I was really confused for about 2-3 minutes.
Yeah, I would be too.
Yeah, me too.
And what it turned out it was... the moon was setting, but there were, I believe, probably ice clouds on that side of the horizon that were, I don't know if they were, I guess my question is it possible that these ice clouds were magnifying the light from the setting moon? Because it looked like half of, you know, I put my hand up and it was probably about two or three hand widths were just lit up in that side of the sky.
Yeah, it could be if there were ice clouds around. That they can generate bright spots in the atmosphere. But if it's a moon, was it a full moon? It must be.
I believe it was pretty close.
Probably pretty close. It could be that. I'm just trying to wonder now that in general, the brightness of the moon is obviously much lighter than the sun. So those spots that you would see would probably still be significantly faint. But again, if you're coming out of dawn, you're probably tired anyway.
The actual sun wasn't quite up yet, yeah. So it was still pretty faint. And, you know, I turned around and then I figured out which way was north. I'm like, okay, the sun's coming up over there. What in the world is that? I had another quick question, and that was this morning we had those big cluster snowflakes falling in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
How do those form? And I'll take my answer to that off the air.
They were all dendrites. They're the six-sided kindergarten as snowflakes that were falling this morning. And they have, as you can remember from drawing them or seeing pictures of them or cutting them out of paper, they have those intricate little, almost antlers-like. And it's as if there's a couple of male deer getting together. And you know how sometimes they get their antlers locked, they can't get unlocked. Same thing's happening with these snowflakes. So they can become big aggregates of what used to be separate dendritic snowflakes. And they just float down as one mass of six or eight or sometimes 12. Yeah, it's interesting.
It's gorgeous, too, when it happens.
Yep. Yeah, it really is. I read somewhere just recently, I don't know if it was in the paper or in a book, but the largest single snowflake that was ever recorded was supposedly 15 inches across.
That seems unbelievable. Yeah, you know, Colorado somewhere?
I had read that, too. It's like the size of a small pizza or a plate. You know, it's just like, geez.
How would you get one that big?
I don't know. It seems like it's got to be somehow contaminated by definition of a snowflake. It would seem to me. How could you get a big disk, effectively, of snow?
Oh, no, it would have to be a
conglomerate.
A conglomerate,
right?
An aggregation.
Then I could believe it.
Yeah.
But even so, they got to be sticky. It must have been falling right near the freezing point so that when they touch, they don't even need to interlock. They kind of stick because there's a little liquid water on the surface. And then they.
And there must have been a lot of them. You would need a lot of crystals and a lot of big ones.
You'd need it to be intense snowfall and perfectly sticky.
Right, yeah. And not too windy, because they didn't break it apart.
Not windy at all.
Yeah.
See how hot it is to make an explanation for something that you can observe? Right. Everything's got to be right about that explanation.
Yeah.
Not just, you can't cherry pick.
Right.
David in South Milwaukee, we'll turn to you. Hi, David.
Hi, two of my favorite guests.
Hey, thank
you. I've been following the Gulf Stream. I also call it the North Atlantic Current. And I read recently a newspaper that thing had been recorded as sputtering lately. Could you comment on that?
No, I hadn't read it. So in my mind, when you said sputtering, it's kind of like just changing its intensity, maybe pulsating, or actually changing directions.
No, good point. Good point. It's actually slowing down, and at one point they said it even stopped for a couple days.
I don't know about that. I think the stream that goes right along, you know, the coast of Florida and the Carolinas is pretty strong, and I think that one is less susceptible to what we call eddies. But as soon as that stream goes off the coast of North American shelf, there can be eddy activity all the way across the Atlantic. And I would guess, I don't know because I'm not an oceanographer, but I would guess that if you enter a period where the eddy activity is higher than normal, then somewhere just, let's say, east of 50 degrees west longitude, you're probably going to notice less of an obvious current to the east because you've got all these eddies floating around in there in the Gulf Stream current. But I don't know if you'd see that right off the coast of North America.
Yeah, they said like up in the North Atlantic. And the reason I think of you guys...
Yeah, the North Atlantic would be this eddy region. That could possibly be part of what might feed into that discussion. I don't know.
Yeah, and part of the thought that, as I understand, is that as increased rainfall and melting actually decreases the level of salinity of the North Atlantic current.
Mm-hmm.
And that can basically it drops in the North Atlantic, pulling the Gulf Stream up, and that could affect it, a very quick ice age in Europe. And interesting weather phenomena with a huge trigger attached to it.
Actually, now that you're saying this, I'm remembering that I had heard something, too, on a news report. I think it was this morning or maybe yesterday, where there was a study a few years ago that looked at the Gulf Stream and thought that it was weakening. But now that they've taken more measurements, they found that during those measurements that they had done previously were too few, so they couldn't actually see the trends. And then actually those few points that they had was just representing the natural variability. And so these issues that you're raising with regard to the Gulf Stream slowing down because of melting ice sheets in the north is something that people are concerned about. Mm-hmm. But the evidence for it occurring... in the past, there was suggestion that it might be, but as they collected more data, that data was inconclusive.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, David. Thanks for calling. Vivian in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Viv.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I am wondering what the global warming would be doing to Milwaukee, doing to the Midwest, doing to other parts of the nation. Do we get more erratic Alberta clippers? Do we get more warmth, more El Nino, La Nina? What's in store for our part of the world?
Those are great questions, Vivian. And I'll tell you, in the next 25 years, we're going to have to solve those questions if we want to make progress on the interface between science and policy, because this is where global warming meets its hottest test as an idea that really needs to be addressed. And that is, we don't really have a great sense of how these things are going to manifest themselves on a local scale. And that's because we don't know enough yet about the interaction between this kind of a global climate change and how it's going to affect the progression of weather systems during the wintertime, or the buildup of cold air over Arctic Canada, for instance, for us. So the questions you ask are ones that are still outstanding, but we realize, as you do, that they're the ones that need to be answered in the next generation.
Yeah, and the issue with regard to the regional impact is the real forefront right now of climate sciences, what's going to happen regionally. But Milwaukee does have one good thing going for it, and that is that it's on the edge of a lake. And big bodies of water tend to moderate impacts a little bit than if in the middle of the continent without any water around you.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Would the water rise?
It'll depend
on
precipitation. You know, the Great Lakes watershed, I've said this several times on the show when I first discovered this, having moved out here, the Great Lakes watershed is extremely small. You don't have to go very far from the shore of the lakes to be out of a region where the water that falls on the ground never finds the lakes.
Yeah.
So the only way the water is going to go up is if precipitation increases in that very small watershed. And then you're talking about an extremely local regional impact, which we can't say, but it's one possibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And right now, as you probably know, the lakes are below normal.
Right.
By about a half a meter or so.
Thank you, Viv.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Nellie in Rusk County, I believe it's your turn next. Hi, Nellie.
Hi. Say, Mike Brindling at Channel 7 in Wausau is a good weatherman, and he still gives the Gulf Stream and the weather currents when they factor the weather and there's a change. And I saw something last week that might answer the man who was wondering about the weather in the plains. It showed a weather current in the cloud patterns going straight north up the west coast.
Yeah, I saw that too. Yep.
Circling over Alaska and then coming right down, headed for Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. That's a big ridge on the west coast. And when that thing sets up, and this was an extraordinarily large one, when that sets up, we get cold.
Yeah, and maybe the plains are still being affected by El Nino.
Mm-hmm. That's possible. And I want to toot our own horn here about Mike Brundling. Mike was a student here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he was very good then, and he's a top-notch guy. I couldn't say anything bad about him. I love the guy, and I wish him well out there.
He's an excellent weatherman. He's the only one we had left.
So there you go.
One from Eau Claire left to go to Arizona.
Yeah, that's right. And we know him, too. He was one of our graduates. We don't teach loyalty classes here.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Might be kind of boring to be a weather guy in, like, Phoenix.
It might be, although this winter, if you're in Flagstaff, it would be awfully exciting. You're getting a lot of snow and some odd things going on there.
So. Yeah, I have some friends in Tucson.
In Tucson, I guess.
Yeah, well, they've gotten a lot of snow and ice.
Yeah,
and...
but I would think in the summertime, you know, it's going to be hot, stay indoors. That'd be the forecast.
That'd be about it. That'd be about it.
Forecast and prescription. All
Pat and Mazamani, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I'm wondering if the predicted volcanic activity out on the West Coast, and actually just volcanic activity and the pressure under the Earth's mantle, has any impact on either global warming or climate?
Not currently. And the reason why I say that is to have an impact on climate, you need really explosive ones. So in 92, for example, we had Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines go off. And that was really explosive in the sense that it sent ash and gases into the stratosphere. And that's like, what is that, like 15 miles up or so?
That latitude even higher than that, maybe.
And so once that gets up there, it can spread around globally and reduce the amount of incoming solar radiation to the surface. And that reduction in the sun energy generally causes a cooling. But if you have other volcanoes that go off, you know, like Mount St. Helens in 1980 or more recently, a couple of years ago, those impacts on weather or the region, I shouldn't really say weather, are really regional in the sense that, I mean, it has a big impact, but not generally on global weather patterns.
Mm. Would that act as a valve for global warming?
It would act as a valve in the sense that it generally leads to a cooling.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, and you know, when Pinatubo went off, it was around that time in the early 90s where a lot of scientists were about to say, yes, global warming is going to occur, is occurring, not going to occur, is occurring. But then when Pinatubo went off, that had an impact of reducing temperatures. Yeah. So it had a perturbation, and what you had to do as a responsible scientist would say, okay, we have to wait for this perturbation to go away and then see what happens. Mm-hmm. And once in 2 years later, after that perturbation went away, then you found a lot of scientists getting on board and saying, yes, everything's back to the warming trends that we've been seeing.
Hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat, for calling. And Jim in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
Yeah, the 15-inch snowflake that you were talking about.
Yeah.
I have some information on that.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, this comes from one of the best books on weather I've ever read. It's called The Handy Weather Answer Book.
I got that one, too.
Yeah.
Isn't that a great book?
It's a great book because it's all in these question-answer format. Yeah. But he writes, Walt Lyons writes that in January 1887, it snowed at Fort Keogh, Montana.
Oh,
and some of the flakes were measured at 15 inches in diameter.
Jeez.
So that's it.
Unbelievable.
Montana.
Montana, yeah.
Biggest I ever saw was maybe 2 inches in Seattle. Really, that's about the biggest I ever saw.
Yeah, I think the biggest I've ever seen was 15. Like a silver dollar. What was that? That's about an inch or so.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Jim.
Yeah. Oh, you
yeah,
bet.
That's great.
I appreciate getting the information. But could you imagine watching snow come down like that?
No, I'd be afraid to go out. I mean, really, that's a lot of mass. How do you get a 15-inch? It's like a snowball coming down on your head.
I think I'd be out there breaking them apart and watching them spread out.
Who and was there'd the be guy? A lot of people out there with cameras.
Who was the guy who caught one and measured it? Now, hats off to him.
Yeah, how do you measure that?
It was you and me clowning around in the snow. We'd never be able to report it.
Right, it would be all over. Then we realized, geez, we should have measured that.
Measured one of them, don't you think?
Well, it probably landed on some flat, cold, flat surface, I suppose. And he happened to have a ruler with him or something.
Yeah, but you have to be careful that it didn't break. So because a lot of when those big flakes that come down, you know, even the quarter size ones, when they hit something, they kind of break apart.
Yeah,
because they must fall pretty slow. 15 inches. 15. That's a big parachute.
That is. Al in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Al.
Hi. Now that President Bush has fired Rush Limbaugh as his science advisor and is turning his attention to global warming, I've seen stories that there are three proposals coming from the White House on ways to counteract global warming. Two come from Bush and one comes from Vice President Cheney. The two Bush proposals, number one is to put a huge amount of acidic aerosol into the upper atmosphere to act like a volcano eruption. The second is to put trillions of tiny beads with metallic reflective surfaces to reflect sunlight. The one from Vice President Cheney is simpler. It's just to bomb Iran to the Stone Age and cause a nuclear winter. And I just wonder if you think any of these things have any chance of success.
The only one that I had heard of, and I thought this came from a scientist who I don't remember, was with the little shiny beads up into the or umbrellas, I think is what they were casted as, up in space to, you know, reflect solar energy back out to space. And, you know, that's, in my mind, that's kind of, in many ways, science fiction. You know, when you start doing, and I don't know if they did this tongue-in-cheek or whatever, but when you know, there's one thing to brainstorm. It's another thing to actually bring those ideas to public.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. The scale on which this has to occur is mind-boggling, and the cost would be mind-boggling. It doesn't seem to stop.
And the impact would be totally unknown.
Right.
That's
right. We
know what would happen, whether it would work or not.
And it seems to me it'd be a lot cheaper and probably more efficient to attack the problem that we know exists instead of trying to devise a valve or a thermostat that'll cost trillions of dollars and we might not even work and then might do things that we don't intend to. And certainly would do things we don't intend to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ludicrous.
Thank you for calling. What are anticyclones, by the way?
Well, they're the opposite of cyclones. These are regions of high pressure at sea level. And a week from today, when you wake up in the southern part of the state, the temperature may be minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and you'll be sitting underneath a fat anticyclone. Surface pressure very high. Circulation around them is clockwise. And so on the eastern side of these things, you drag down Arctic Canada over southern Wisconsin. And they're just the flip side of cyclones. They come in sequence. Cyclones have clouds and weather with them. Anticyclones, clear skies, and in the wintertime, bone-chilling cold.
And so we're going to get, you're predicting temperatures minus 20?
Minus 20 Fahrenheit at the airport on Monday morning, February 5th. Maybe even colder.
Whoa!
Winter is here.
It's coming. It's coming.
Winter is definitely here, and yes, that it means it'll be cold everywhere in Wisconsin.
Probably so. In fact, tomorrow is the anniversary from 1951 of the coldest day in Madison's history, January 30th, 1951, minus 37. So count your lucky stars. We're not going to get
that. We're not going to
get
that, though. But I got a feeling I'm going to be sick on Monday. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I'm sick that you guys can't be on longer. We're out of time. So we'll join. You'll join us again last Monday of next month?
Yeah,
so
we sure will.
We'll do it all over again. All right. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. Stay with us.